Welcome back, everyone. Thank you for joining us here in the Members Hour. We are talking with Ben Davidson from Suspicious Observers, and we talked about some of the things here has to do with that there's so much information out there. There's so much documentation. There's so much reports. These are going to be conflicting to a certain extent, and there's variances in all of this stuff. And one of the other problems on top of this is, of course, that you have confirmation bias. You go out there, you want to, you know, find what you already have set your mind to, what you believe is the truth and all that. So, Ben, with all the reports, the different measurements that scientists are taking, how do you go about filtering some of that information? And we have an issue as well, not only, of course, of the actual reports of the measurements and the scientific data that's coming in. On top of that, you have the interpretation, the omission to a certain extent, and the presentation of that material as well. So how do you navigate in between all this stuff?
Well, that is often a very, very difficult task. First thing I do is I try to go find the source of something. Oftentimes, you'll read an article and it'll paint a very, very different picture of a paper that has been published than you would get if you were to just even go read the abstract yourself. I'm finding that when I can, it's best to link the actual paper or source, the actual manuscript, even if it's just the abstract, because you'll often find that the story that's being purported is often some kind of a secondary or tertiary suggestion about a potential way that one could expound on this data. But, sometimes it's quite easy. Like, for example, when it comes to reporting on the sun, there are literally thousands of people all over the globe with very, very good telescopes, with very, very good solar filters. Every day I'm taking a look, making sure that all the sunspots look where they're supposed to be based on some of the other satellite images were given. I know a lot of people are skeptical about some of the satellite images, but, you know, people like you and me with telescopes don't lie, and auroras don't lie. Radio blackouts don't lie. And these are the kind of things that we do see.
Absolutely. Now, the other thing I wanted to ask you a bit more about here has to do with some of the politics of climate change. I was taking a little sneak peek on the Agenda 21 section that you have on the website, on your website, about this as well. And I was just curious of hearing a little bit more about that and kind of your angle and your approach to that particular aspect. How much of this is threatening, if you will, what actually is going on right now with how they're using climate change to, as I said, early on in the first hour, to kind of reform really society, and specifically in the Western world.
Well, absolutely. We briefly discussed how there are at least two powerful groups at work. One is very, very prevalent in this space, you could say. This would be the human-driven global warming, the IPCC, mandatory implementation plans, the ICLEI, using non-governmental organizations to implement things like Agenda 21. Agenda 21 doesn't in anywhere inside of it say anything that hits you as evil. But some of the quotes of the people who have written it, and when you realize where interpretation can take you when it comes to a written work, it starts to get a little scary when you hear some of the people who are in charge talking about the Western world is essentially the enemy of all humanity because of the way it lives. I would argue that everybody try to be a little less wasteful, try to be better to the environment. The health argument for pollution is undeniable. However, telling a lie to get us to do things that we maybe should or shouldn't be doing already probably isn't the best way to go about it. And I really don't appreciate being lied to by those people. And most people don't appreciate that either once they realize exactly how they're being lied to. However, for every $1 billion that is spent pushing this anthropogenic global warming agenda, there is at least $1 billion spent against it. There is a series, it is a members series on my website called Agenda 21 Counterstrike. Now, I do dissent against the implementation of Agenda 21, and it is very much a counterstrike against the juggernaut that is the UN IPCC Agenda 21 platform. But I also would like to step in against some of the crazier, as I call them, things that are said about Agenda 21. There are claims made about it that don't do anybody any good, that are unsubstantiated, that essentially require you to believe the worst imagination of the author based on the worst possible interpretation of the words that have actually been written. And what we've found is that most of the people who have heard about Agenda 21 think it's some kind of crazy conspiracy, and they think things like it's, people say it's a plan to depopulate the world. If you go and you read what Agenda 21 actually says, it wants to see things like being less wasteful, more efficient, equality for women, reducing poverty, reducing starvation, child welfare, making sure kids don't die, making sure that everybody in the world has access to health, proper health. And the most extreme voices on that side say, well, that can never happen if we get another America. If China turns into the United States, we're all screwed because we can't handle anything else like that. And there may be some truth to those statements. However, you also have, things like the Post-Sustainability Institute, the Heartland Institute, and 100 other pass-throughs of money that would be on the other side. If one would consider the environmental side to be the left side or the Democrat side, and a lot of Democrats are actually appalled at this, that it is a Democratic Agenda 21, 100%. There is strong pushback on the other side. Chapter 3 of Agenda 21 Counterstrike lays out just how perfectly matched these two sides are. It's very, very strange that in the mainstream news, and what you hear about is just the global warming side of the story.
Yeah.
And again, when you come into our community, you just hear about, oh, it's just all these evil people. It's all the elites. It's Agenda 21. They're all part of this conspiracy. There's evidence for some sort of this, hey, we want to keep this our gentleman's game up here at the top. We don't want anybody else coming and playing with us. There's evidence of that in many forms. They're also trying to win. They want to beat the other one worse than you could possibly imagine. These people don't worry about money or things like that. This is life to those people, coming out on top in situations like this. Now, what I had once thought was an unfair term, the liberal media, I over time am coming to agree with as I see just one side of this story played out over and over again. While the billions of dollars spent on the other side somehow don't have as loud of a megaphone.
Yeah.
But they definitely exist, and that's a key point of Agenda 21 Counterstrike, Chapter 3.
Well, do you think as well that this has been I mean, I've always seen this, that they very cleverly work this into a political issue as opposed to the actual issue of what it's about. I mean, people are so reactionary in terms of the narrow political spectrum that they actually think that just because, you know, Glenn Beck actually has highlighted Agenda 21 now, people think that it doesn't exist, you know, right? It's just a right-wing conspiracy. And it's actually by favoring Agenda 21 that we can actually counteract all those, you know, stupid claims. And on top of that, you have strawman arguments and sensationalizations and stuff like that, just to kind of, again, it doesn't really stick to the issues. It kind of just makes the whole debate kind of fall apart. Yeah.
Well, you know, this is the same argument that has played out throughout history. Century after century, generation after generation. How best to solve the biggest problems in our society? And, you know, nobody argues essentially what the right outcomes are. You know, go find me a Democrat or Republican, somebody on either side who doesn't want to, you know, decrease poverty or decrease, you know, child starvation or things like that. Where this money is going in terms of the Republican side is it's going into government lobbies, because for them, this is an economic issue. This is carbon taxes. This is EPA restrictions. This is you can't, you know, pollute this much here, this much there. And as I said before, the health effect of pollution should make us change the game. It really should. But it shouldn't be used for a climate lie, is probably the best way that I can put it.
Yeah.
You know, for them, I mean, you know, ExxonMobil is one of the biggest contributors to these private funds, these private capital groups. And they lobby Congress. They lobby leaders. That's how that side is doing it. That's why we don't see it as much. You know, there was a while when tobacco lobbyists were making the news, but that was only because there was hundreds of millions of dollars in a lawsuit on the line. We didn't get to see any of what was going on for the years and years and years when they were behind closed doors because of millions and millions and millions of dollars. It's the exact same kind of thing. And so we have the, what I can only call, I mean, I don't know really how to term it in any other way than Republican or Democrat or right and left, but you have these groups who are going against Agenda 21 and against these climate lies, and they're saying, no, you guys are full of it. The planet's not doing that. But they're doing it because arguing for that will make them more money. On the other side, you have them arguing for, you know, all of these things, how we have to change. Oh, we're doing all these terrible things for the planet. And who says that we don't need to make some changes as a species? But doing the right thing for the wrong reason doesn't sit well with most people, and probably shouldn't. Now, I will say this. There is one point upon which both sides agree, and I can't find a official government or fund or NGO or any organization on either side that doesn't include an element of personal responsibility in their vision for the future.
Right.
They all say that we all need to take some kind of responsibility for ourselves. And I'll tell you, living in the country I live in, I have a very good appreciation for that statement when I see the lack of responsibility of a significant percentage of this country. I mean, it might be as much as, you know, 20 or 30% of the entire country is just completely irresponsible. And that's terrifying to me sometimes. I know that's not true where you live.
Well, the fact here, though, is that there you don't have the opportunity for people to be personally responsible, because you have a government that takes care of everything for you. And I mean, if you look at the pamphlets and stuff like that that are sent out, they literally are turning into these children books now. And it's just hilarious to see. And it's the worst end of the flip side of that debate. Again, it's like it leaves no room for, you know, you thinking for yourself. You're just basically told by the authoritarians in charge what to do, how to act. And then they actually, by economic policy, basically force you into a corner. And I despise that way of doing business as well, you know?
That's a very bright statement. I like that. That's a good perspective.
Now, another point as well on this, then, there are people who transcend the political limitations on this particular issue as well. You know, we had Rosa Kourian. She's a Democrat. Wow, a Democrat.
Democrats against Agenda 21. Absolutely. I feature Rosa's work a good bit, and I have some links to some of her work as well on the site.
Very good, very good. People can check out that for more, you know, in depth on that, your Agenda 21 section there. But I wanted to switch gears a little bit here again, and you mentioned to me as well, Ben, that you've been focusing on the what you call the tectonic aspect a little bit. Can you lead us into that and see how it connects with some of the other issues we talked about?
Absolutely. The United States Geological Survey keeps a very nice little list of all the 8-magnitude earthquakes from basically 1900 to present. Now, when you exclude the first decade or two back before we had real widespread detection systems, you can really see this pattern of increasing earthquake activity peaking pretty much now. We get an average over the long term of 1 8-magnitude earthquake a year, just over the long run. Well, we had a couple of them in 2006. We had 4 of them in 2007. We didn't have one in 2008, but we did have a 7.9 in China, which was the most devastating earthquake for years before that, since the disaster in Sumatra in 2004, the Christmas quake, as it's known. In 2009, we had one. In 2010, we had a big one. In 2011, it was a 9-pointer. In 2012, we had 2 on the same day, April 11th, and we had 2 in 2013. That is a statistically significant increase from the long-term average of 1 per year, if you look back to 2006, just over the last 8 years. Now, the story of this really starts on April 11th, 2012, the day where we had 2 8-pointers within just a few hours of one another in Sumatra, pretty close to where the 9-pointer created the terrible tsunami. Now, neither of these was anything close to that event. But afterwards, there was, I can't remember the name now, and I remember not being able to pronounce it, so maybe that's okay. But he was a Romanian scientist, and I remember that he was saying that based on what had happened since 2004 with the 9-pointer in Sumatra and all the quakes in 96 and 97, and then with what had happened in Japan, and then we had 2 8-pointers on the same day in 2012, he had said, guys, this is too much. The fault lines are destabilizing. This is not, like, these are not random, unlinked events. And people called him crazy. He released this before the month of April was out. And I remember thinking that this was a very, very interesting thing for so many people just to be calling this scientist crazy who studies these things, and for them to be calling him crazy and wrong within just days of the article coming out, which I don't know if you know anything about the manuscript submission, review, resubmission process, peer review. It's not done in a couple of days, that's for sure.
Right.
But later in 2012, it was September, couple of scientists from Cal Berkeley claiming to make some significant discoveries of their own said that those 2 8-pointers in April had ripped 5 separate fault systems. You look and these extend down past the Indian Ocean all the way into the South Pacific and all the way up to Japan and past it. They also said that the bigger of the 8-pointers that happened on April 11th rang the entire planet like nothing they'd ever seen. There were a number of 6.5 to 7 magnitude earthquakes within a week of that. And the guys at Cal Berkeley said, I believe it was Cal Berkeley, they said that these were all tied to the initial event, that it actually triggered tectonic instability across the entire planet. One of those earthquakes was in Mexico, across the entire Pacific. That's nowhere near the fault lines that were actually ripped. So, after that, we have an 8-pointer in February of 2013 in the Solomon Islands, less than a year from the double 8-pointers. Then in May, the second 8-pointer of 2013, an 8.3 that made news for a different reason. This was in Russia. This was way underground in Kamchatka. And it made news because, according to everything they know about the planet, we're not supposed to be able to get an 8.3 magnitude earthquake that far below the surface. It's just not supposed to happen. I think that it's also becoming clear that just as what's going on above our heads is a bit beyond us, the same thing can be said about what's happening beneath our feet.
Right.
For all I know, it could go back to normal tomorrow and we might not get another 8-magnitude quake for a decade. That's not what the data shows. And that's not what some of these scientists are saying. And boy, I'll tell you what, the people who were calling that Romanian guy crazy had nothing to say when Cal came out with their papers. They had nothing to say whatsoever. And you know, it's not just these earthquakes in that area. There's a lot of stuff happening in that specific area of the world. Now, we're focusing back in on Indonesia and up north to Sumatra. One of the most popular videos I did last year was called Disturbance Under the Ocean. There are these buoys all over the ocean, always checking the water levels. Part of what they do is, you know, they check for tsunamis. They basically just they're maintained by a number of different countries and organizations, and there's a couple of places you can go and just watch the data pretty much in pretty much real time. Well, there's this one buoy south of Bali, and it just kept rising. The buoy baseline kept rising and rising, signifying that the water level at that buoy was going down and down and down. And since it wasn't happening at either of the buoys to the side of it, and since there was no evidence of some giant depression in the middle of the ocean, what conclusion could you come to if there was a slow, very, very slow drop in the sea level at that one location only? It must be a rise in the sea floor at that location only.
Mm-hmm.
And so at this point, they have taken that buoy out completely. It's not even on the map. Every time it started doing this, they'd let it would go for a couple of days. It would start to make the news, go around the internet, and then they'd shut it off. A couple of months later, they'd turn it back on. It would make news within just a few days, and they'd have to shut it off. It's now completely gone, and from everything I can tell, they're not bringing it back.
Huh.
But anyway, we're talking about within the span of a few weeks, hundreds of feet. Over the span of a few months, it was over 1,000 feet. Now, people would ask things like, well, why isn't there a tsunami? Well, if you picture yourself sitting in the bathtub or you're in a pool taking a swim, If your hand is, say, a foot underneath the water, and you raise it up really fast, even if you don't bring your hand out of the water, you're going to see the water ripple up at the top. But if you pull your hand up very, very slowly, you're not going to notice a thing on the top of the water. And that's the kind of thing we're talking about here. A small area rising very, very quickly. And of course, we no longer have that data point, and so we are left now with our memories of it. But volcanoes in that area, and if I would have to take a best guess, I do believe that there is an underwater volcano that is billowing up from underground at that location at this time. Right. Whether or not that'll be significant in our lifetimes, I don't know. But there are a bunch that are significant right now there, and people are being evacuated in some places. There's constantly new eruptions. It's not a good place to be seismically or volcanically in the world.
Well, you have this interplay as well. As we know, no one of these areas is isolated and stand on their own. Everything is connected in that way. And when you have input or output of energy in some kind into the system, that will have its own effects. And even onset of ice ages will, or the mini ice ages even will cause tremendous strain on the shape of the planet due to the weight alone of the ice, etc. Which means you have a different aspect to the tectonic bit as well. So all of these things are kind of interrelated. I'm not saying that we're going into an ice age right now and therefore we have these changes, but the fact is that if we talk about these massive catastrophes in the past and the way that they have been changing the landscape on the planet, there's just, it's not just coming from one aspect. We're talking about multiple different effects on the planet that's going to all contribute to the changing climate. And if you have volcanic eruptions on top of that, you have further blocking out of sunlight, which further kind of continues that downward spiral,
Oh, absolutely. I think you summed that up very nicely.
So is there anything else to that particular, why we're seeing those types of seismic changes or the periodicity of those or the way that they're kind of, the pattern? I was trying to find the name because I remember who you're talking about. I'm trying to find the name of the Romanian scientist. I forgot it.
The article was in the Croatian Times, I believe, I'm not mistaken. At this point we are, we have done a good job of summarizing the past, understanding the past, and realizing that we are in a significant time. Now we just have to wait for the next one and all the while wait for this all to end. I find it very interesting that this seems to be happening at the same time that our weather is going haywire. Much of the world is in disarray, whether that's politically, economically, or in battle. It's a lot of things converging in this one time. It's probably what made for such a convincing story last year in 2012, if I had to take a guess.
Now, all right, let's get into this other aspect then, Ben, in terms of our own influence and what we actually do. You mentioned that briefly, in the first segment as we ending there, in terms of how our thoughts, how our intentions influence the outcome of things. And maybe there's even a more powerful aspect when people actually focus on the same thing and whatnot. But you have this little video called, I Am Harp. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yes. There are a lot of people who say that I will never do another video that was as beneficial as that one. The idea of I Am Harp is that if you were to say I Am Harp, you would not be completely wrong. Now, granted, you do not have a giant antenna array or any receivers sticking out of your skull. At least I hope not. And you probably can't pull the megawatts through your skull. At least I hope not. But the idea that we have brain waves, this should not be foreign to most people. Our brain has different kinds of waves. This is electromagnetic radiation. It is a waveform that manipulates positive and negative. Now, on a very formal scale, testing this and testing some of the effects, Princeton University created what's called the Global Consciousness Project, and they found that random number generators, you know, these things are in everything from a poker machine to your computer. Random number generators lose the ability to be random when influenced by significant human brain waves. It's one of the most baffling things that these or any scientist has ever found. And they still to this day do not purport to understand exactly why our brain waves do this. But nevertheless, they found that it did happen. And so they wanted to go see just what effect the human thoughts were having on the world in real time, given that their precedent had been set that, yes, human waves, just like human brain waves, just like sound waves from thunder or the bass in a loud bass in a car can shake your house or your leg, or and just the way that scalar waves can change water vapor and change the weather and things like that, your brain waves can change the world. It's proven. And so what they did was they took these very, very specialized random number generators, ones built to be very sensitive to human thoughts, much more so they could actually pick up these things on a broad scale. And they started figuring out after they put these things all over the world that when significant events were happening all over the world, these random number generators, which they call electrogyograms, they started registering in such a way that you could tell that the consciousness of the entire planet was changing in that moment. Now, they have a list of correlated events a mile long on their website. Well, one of them is so baffling and so kind of scary, actually, that you know I don't talk about it much, and they don't talk about it very much either, but you start to look at a couple of their graphs that they put together for each event, and you pretty quickly start to figure out how these things work. Well, one of the biggest readings we have is for 9/11, when the towers came down. But the issue is that the spike began 5 hours before the first plane hit, before anybody knew anything was going on.
Right.
Now, the extreme of this would be things like precognition or remote viewing, but you don't need to go anywhere near that fringe to realize just how real this stuff is. All right, given that we've proven that brain waves can do this, let's look at some of the other things that are based on nothing but our brains and what we're thinking, how we make the conscious decision to manipulate those things. The power of positive thinking, of laughter, of prayer, do not work for everybody, but it works for many. The documented proof of laughter and positive thinking on cancer patients, especially children, says something about their minds. When they truly believe that they can do it, that they've just got to fight, they've just got to keep smiling, they tend to do better. And it's statistically significant. Let's take a look at something that every adult is aware of, but we all think is pretty mundane. And I happen to think it's one of the most important and telling pieces of our lives. The placebo effect. Do you know what the placebo effect is in reality? In reality, that is your brain taking over and basically saying that, you know, even though the fact that what it believes to be true based on biology, chemistry, and physics, even though all of that is false, it's just going to make it so.
Right.
It's just going to make it happen. It's going to ignore the rules of science and the universe as we know them. And the thing that you think in your brain is just going to become real. I think this is one of the most significant things in this line of thinking, in this line of consciousness, the power of positivity, how you think, how you act, what kind of person you are. I think this is one of the most significant things, and it's also one of the most ignored in this as well. I have spent some time looking at websites that are dedicated to things like consciousness and Kabbalah and third eye stuff. I don't get into it as much as, you know, I find it interesting for sure. I just don't have the time, as I'm sure you could tell. But this idea is, and you have to realize, I have accurately characterized the placebo effect. Your brain thinks that there is a highly powerful chemical that is known to do something very, very specific to your body. You don't have that chemical in you, but you're going to have the effects for no other reason than you think so. People don't think about this. They ignore this. We have no idea how powerful we are. The brain waves that are going through your mind and my mind right now are probably going to interact with each other somewhere. And they're going out to the edges of the universe right now. And people pay these thoughts in that way almost no mind. Who's to say that there's not an intelligence out there that can read these things?
Right.
What sorts of brain waves are they reading from this region of space? Anyway, maybe I'm wrong, but I think that the placebo effect is a pretty good way to understand that there is something to this stuff. And, you know, even the people who run these websites and give these talks, none of them claim to have all the answers. But, you know, I got to tell you, I found a lot of this when I was actually on your website a bit ago, going down through some of your more recent talks. And, you know, I know a lot of those names. You got really good taste here, my friend. A lot of these people are on to really, really good things. And I don't think any single one of them would tell you that they're not capable of making a mistake about something here or there.
Sure.
You know? Mistakes are something that so many people in these communities are so afraid of them.
Well, maybe it's just the thing that we need to, as we said before, kind of add that unknown variable to the potential outcome and reversals of all kinds of stuff that's going on in the natural world, you know, right now and on this planet. And maybe it's that realization. Maybe it's even this necessity, if you will, of these things that we're going through that is going to force us to examine these type of areas, because otherwise, as we know from before, if you're not challenged in these ways, if you're not in that regard kind of, you know, pushed into the corner a little bit, we don't need to go there. But in this case, if things goes bad enough, who knows where we'll be, you know, 10, 15, 20 years from now, and what we'll actually have learned about the brain and the continuation of our influence, you know, on the material world.
Yeah, I would agree completely.
What was the chemical, by the way, you mentioned that you said we don't have it in our brain, but we have the effect of it? Like,
for example, they will test, and this is actually going to become part of standard regulatory procedure for new pharmaceuticals, is they're going to have to pass a placebo test, because they're finding more and more that you just have to tell these people that they're getting a powerful chemical that's going to do this to their cancer.
Oh, yeah.
They may see this, and this side effect, blah, blah, blah. They're finding that that's all they have to do, and their results are about the same. And it's not that there's something wrong with the chemical. necessary. There's a lot wrong with the greed that goes into the process and some of the exorbitant prices charged, but it doesn't change the fact that the chemical does what the chemical does to you chemically. It's just that if you truly believe this to be true, you have the ability to do everything that that billion-dollar chemical compound can do that took PhDs decades to invent and decades more to get through regulatory agencies in the United States and Europe. It took your brain a day or two. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when we put that into the larger context as well, we can understand why it has been so important, I think, to harness belief from the point of view of media, education, to kind of to harness and to really focus and sharpen that attention into certain areas. And of course, people have to therefore ask themselves what the feedback loop here is. And, I'm not trying to suggest here either that, we shouldn't, look at things that are negative because it would just affect us too badly. I think there's an interaction and a play between being informed, understanding what's going on, but at the same time, then have an understanding of, if you just suffer from the consequences of these things without feeling that you've actually empowered yourself with knowledge and then consequently being able to do something about it, it is going to have a downturn aspect to it. And I think that, again, and the more people would focus on, we're being told constantly climate change, global warming, again, what does that actually do to the physical world?
Yeah, that's a good point. I should probably take my own advice as I hear you say that and be more mindful of some of my own brainwaves sometimes. I think we could probably all use that advice from here and there, but
sure, yeah.
That's something I hadn't necessarily considered as much. There's so many moving parts to this. You take the Antarctic, for example, where we described how those human-driven climate change agenda propagandists, if you will, basically got stuck in the ice down in Antarctica trying to prove global warming. So the part that's exposed to us is colder, but underneath Antarctica, it is melting so fast that it actually stands to change our entire planet on its own. I mean, it's going to be a combination of all these things, and they're all going to factor together. But even if none of that other stuff was happening, the amount of freshwater introduction from the base of, from the underside of Antarctica, where it's freezing under there, is it's phenomenal. And it's enough to change the planet on its own.
What's causing that? Are we more underwater volcanoes, or how do we explain that?
Well, our SUVs, of course, and our hairspray.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm not kidding. They said it's global warming.
Right.
It's
underneath the ice, it's global warming, but on top, it's global cooling.
They don't specifically say that humans are causing this massive freshwater waterfall, essentially underground, under the ice, which is what it is. And I think it would probably have to be volcanic activity. But they kind of transition from this is happening, this fresh water, right into humans are doing all of this, and if we don't stop, we're going to be in trouble. And it's like all of a sudden they went from talking about something that humans couldn't possibly have anything to do with, and they turned it into a global warming story. I mean, that's how this was presented.
Yeah.
To us. This was actually a couple of months ago. There was a pretty good visualization given. I believe it was Goddard's scientific visualization studio. And we showed it in the news. And it was, it was very, very pretty to look at, but it was essentially at the underside of the ice, rapid melting and essentially a freshwater waterfall. And, when you have this huge mass of fresh water, it's actually going to stay separate from the mass of salt water somewhat. I mean, they're going to intermingle, but this mass is so big that it essentially moves just as a freshwater mass from underneath Antarctica out into the ocean, and they're figuring out that this is quickly changing the seafloor. You know, I hadn't thought about it before this moment, but all these things that we're not supposed to see in beaches, you know, that are beaching themselves, or we're not supposed to see them this close to the coast, or we're not supposed to see them there at this time of year, can't help but wonder if this is maybe just a contributing factor.
Right.
To that.
Yeah. Well, it's very, very interesting. I mean, this is something that will, you know, continue, and you know, this battle, not only then for the information, but for the hearts and minds, the belief ultimately of people, is also something that's going to continue. And who knows, maybe that's even the more important, you know, battle, if you want to call it that. But I wanted to ask you something else here before we begin to round things up for this time, Ben, and that had to do with basically the debris field of comets. And I would just say, I hate to bring up Elenin again, but I believe that you talked in one of your videos about this aspect that we're actually entering into the debris field of that comet right now, as the time we're doing this program anyway.
You mean Comet Ison?
Ison, sorry. Yeah, that's
right. It's all right. I mentioned Comet Elenin in the first segment, so that's fully...
That's probably why.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. And at this point, we are pretty much coming out of that debris stream right now. There is evidence that we did see at least one tiny little rock. Didn't come anywhere near the ground, but we saw one rock that looked like it had an Ison-like trajectory. Now, I said a year and a half ago, when this comet was discovered and they plotted this trajectory, which has changed less than 1% in that year and a half, by the way, I remember thinking that people were going to be confused at this time, because it will have made big news that Ison was going around the sun. I didn't realize it was going to make this big a news, but when we get these potential, when we get this dusting of meteors, like I think we should get as we go through its debris stream from where it came into the inner system, people are going to associate that with the comet having come back around the sun and bombarding us from there. Now, in reality, the comet itself is virtually gone at this point. There are probably some rocks left, very, very minor, nothing that could survive a trip through our atmosphere. But they're way, way, way north, and at this point, they're well behind Earth. They've passed Earth's trajectory. However, we are in the middle of the area where Ison was a couple of months ago. You know, we get these annual meteor showers every year. A lot of people go out in August and see some of the meteor showers. There's a couple of good ones in November. And what these actually are is we're actually going through the debris stream, the exact point where a comet had been decades ago, maybe centuries ago. Some of these annual meteor showers that we get are from 100-year-old comets. Now, we're going through the debris stream of Ison on year one. Not even year one. It's like month seven or month six. Oh my God, I'm sorry, it's not even close to that. It's like month three or month four after Ison was in that exact position. And so, all right, this is year one. Let's look for some. Now, we didn't get any kind of any major events in the last couple of days, and we are on the backside of this now. So we are, you know, less and less likely to see these things as time goes on. And even in the official fireball records from the AllSky Network, I only see one rock that really fits an Ison-like trajectory. Now, there's hundreds that they don't catch every day.
Happen,
you know. But, I am happy to see this comet go, finally, and be done with it. But, yeah, that was a vastly confusing part of this potential meteor issue with Ison.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do concur. Well, I think we should wrap things up here for this time. I want to thank you for your time today, Ben. Glad to have you with us on the program. We'll probably see you in Albuquerque in March then at the Thunderbolts, you know, Electric Universe conference. That's going to be a lot of fun to be there. But let's give out your website once more for people who want to, you know, follow your morning weather updates and everything else you have to offer there.
Absolutely. For weather and space weather, it is youtube.com/user/suspiciousobservers. You could probably just put suspicious observers into Google, Bing, or Yahoo, or any internet search engine. The first two things that are going to come up are going to be my website and my YouTube channel. I'm very happy to say that the internet search engines have figured out what people are looking for when they search for the suspicious observers now. So the website is suspiciousobservers.org. And again, the O in observers is a zero. I really do appreciate you having me on. It was very much a pleasure to talk to you, and I look forward to doing it again.
Very good. Definitely. Thank you so much, Ben. We'll have the links up for everyone who wants to check that out from redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com. All right. Well, thanks. We'll wrap up for this time. See you later. All right, everybody, we have much more to come. For now, we say thank you for listening and for being a member. Don't forget our news feed on redicecreations.com, or you can grab the RSS feed on redicemembers.com, along with the radio show feeds, of course. If you haven't subscribed to those yet, I urge you to check that out and to do so. It's a great way of getting the latest show directly to you as soon as new programs are out and available. We have tons more coming up, some very exciting shows with some great guests in the pipeline, so stay with us and hold on as well, I guess. It's just a very interesting, intense zone right now. It's, of course, always good to go with the flow of things, but I don't know, it's easy to get swept away as well and get lost, so hold on to the things that you do value the most. I think it's important. Stay well, healthy, and alert. And I hope we'll talk to you in just a few days. Bye for now.